Good. Okay, this is an interview with Francine Frank. It's March, no it's not, it's April 3rd, 1997. And we're going to talk a little bit about the history of the Women's Studies Department at SUNY Albany. You were there at the beginning.
I was there at the beginning as kind of a little bit peripherally as a bystander, because I wasn't actively involved. But I knew about it in a kind of quasi-administrative way. Like, I don't know what I was. I was some sort of a coordinator of something or other. Who knows what? Interdisciplinary programs, I think. And so I knew about the real early days, and I also knew about the discussion of where it should be housed, because at the time we had a College of Arts and Sciences, but we had deans of divisions, and the general feeling was, even though there was a lot of social science, that it should be housed in humanities, because the then dean of humanities was a woman, which was much more sympathetic to it than the then dean of social science. So that's how it actually ended up in humanities. And I think that was even before Joan became the director. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Real early days.
Right.
And, you know, and I knew the people involved, I was supportive of it, and I knew about the early days of the teaching collective, but I wasn't kind of myself part of it at that time. I don't even remember when I got involved in terms of being on the advisory committee, somewhere in the 70s.
Mm-hmm. When, do you recall when you started teaching or cross-listing courses with us? Or maybe, I mean, I don't need, I'm not talking specific dates, but, you know, what courses or...
Well, my own involvement came first when Joan Schultz was teaching Perspective on Women and asked me to come in as one of the guest lecturers and talk about language and linguistics. And I thought, I said, sure. And then I thought, well, what am I going to talk about? This must have been fairly early on. It was in the 70s. And I thought, crazy, I don't know what to say. And that's actually what made me get interested in doing my own work on language and gender. Because up to then I thought, I've been active because, and I guess one of the reasons that I was involved in women's studies is I was very active in the Caucus on Women's Rights and chaired it and I co-chaired it and co-chaired this SUNY-wide one. And even though it was not women's studies, obviously the people were concerned and there was, you know, we had like a subcommittee that was supportive of women's studies with the discipline. And so I always thought, well, it's too bad, you know, linguistics doesn't have anything to do with gender. And so it's nice that some people can actually combine their own research with teaching in it. And then when I started thinking about what I was going to talk about and discovered that people had thought of lots of things that I had never thought about, I got quite excited about it. And that basically what set me going and what made me think about offering a course and language and gender, which I offered first, I think it was the fall of 1976. The spring of 1976. It might have been the fall of 75. And the reason I remember that is because I was going to give this course at the Summer Institute of the Linguistic Society of America at Oswego that year. And so I wanted to try it out, test it out, by offering it here first. So I know that was the first time I taught it. I'll just let it hang on.
Okay. Let me turn this off for a minute. Okay. That'll probably come
Let's
off
see
better because we're closer to it.
Any better now.
So, and that course, the first time I offered that course, I think it was cross-listed with women's studies. I have given it several times since then, but most recently, actually, in the last few years, and it's always been cross-listed with women's studies.
When I know that I was on the advisory committee before I became dean, because when I became dean, I thought it's probably smart not to be on the advisory committee.
it was while I was dean that it became a department.
Right.
Bonnie Spann, who was the director, and she wrote a memo one day and said, we should be a department. We have this and we have that and we have the other thing. Mm-hmm. And I said, she's right. So I wrote a memo, because becoming a department is an administrative mm-hmm. decision that the president made. And everybody said, okay. And that's how we became a department.
Wonderful.
It was really interesting.
Right. That it seemed so easy.
Uh-huh. It was a good time, because I think a few interdisciplinary programs were becoming departments.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just
right.
worked
right.
out well.
As opposed to what we're going through now, trying to get a master's program.
Well, I
it
think
seems to take so long.
Yeah, it's a long process, but I think what happened is it really just fell between the cracks
mm-hmm.
somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody thought somebody else had it.
Right.
That's what happened actually with the bachelor's degree proposal.
Mm.
Because all of these programs, these interdisciplinary programs on women's studies, started out as being some kind of, we had this umbrella interdisciplinary major
yes.
with a concentration in
mm-hmm.
women's studies, and the proposal to make it a regular major got stuck in somebody's desk drawer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was, I don't think it was with malice or anything, it was
mm-hmm.
somebody who left, it was a funny situation, and only after lots of questioning and poking along did they discover it, and once they sent it on its way, it,
mm-hmm.
it was fine. But it's always a fairly long process, because
mm-hmm.
it's got to go through governance, it has to go to the state.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm glad that it got rediscovered so that we can do it, because that's
right.
important
yeah.
to have a master's.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And pave the way,
yeah.
hopefully, for a doctorate someday.
Yeah, that would be very nice.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the program is really strong in terms of also the faculty, the people that are in it, and I don't see any reason why
mm-hmm.
they shouldn't have a doubt.
Assuming
that the student interest will continue to be there.
Right. And there's willingness on the part of the administration to continue to support women's studies.
Hopefully.
As people retire.
You never notice. You never know what's going to happen.
That's
you know?
Right.
One person changes and a lot of things mm-hmm. can change.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's well enough established. So that it's not, it may not, it, any growth might be slowed down, but I don't think it's going to go away.
Right. Well, I think there'll be demand for it,
mm-hmm.
too. Did you ever teach any of the core courses?
No, I never did. I had that long period when I wasn't really doing
mm-hmm.
much in the way of teaching. So within that time, there might have been a time when I might have taught
mm-hmm.
perspectives or maybe even
the collective
monster job. But I wasn't, I taught occasionally, and I was then in two departments,
mm-hmm.
also linguistics and in Spanish at the
right.
time. So my teaching was kind of used up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So basically, it's interesting, because the only actual teaching that I've done in women's studies has been this language and gender
mm-hmm.
course, an occasional
right.
lecture. But one of the things that, you know, that in the program and department gave me the impetus to do that is while I was dean, I was fairly active in talking with national groups of deans and administrators about women's studies, about
mm-hmm.
curriculum infusion or curriculum transformation. And of course, I learned all of that from my colleagues in the women's studies here. I saw three women deans once gave a panel on curriculum transformation at a meeting of the Council of Colleges of Arts and Sciences, which is basically a dean's
mm-hmm.
organization. And it was very well received, but I was also quite shocked to find out how many deans really knew nothing about women's studies.
Really?
Yeah. At the time, and it was about 10 years ago, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a useful thing to do, and everybody said how well coordinated and useful this was, because at those meetings when they had panels of several people, they often didn't discuss ahead of time what they were going to do, and we had it all nicely, being conscientious women.
Right, right.
Yeah,
we always
out. Right.
Do it.
Right.
just so.
Right. And of course, then I use our program as an example. Mm-hmm. And also, there was a lot of talk at the time about whether you need to, how you go about making sure you get some kind of critical mass of faculty in women's studies. And we had only a couple of people at that time. Mm-hmm. And really, the only line, I think, was Bonnie.
Right.
But a strange thing happened. Because of all that time when we were going out, doing outreach to other departments, getting courses cross-listed, and even though we weren't getting any lines specifically for women's studies, departments were suddenly beginning to hire people who did women's studies. And it really, well, that's a lot of our associates and even joint faculty right. came that way. They weren't people who were here before who then got interested. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, at the beginning, between Joan Schultz and Bonnie Spanier, we had this kind of strange procedure where we would get a person to be director who would also have a joint appointment in some other department and would then go into that department afterwards. And so that's how we got Iris Berger and Chris Bowes.
Right. And then the top appointments came
along. And then the top appointments came along, right. Mm-hmm. And we were able to take, well, actually, we only had one person on the top appointment. And that was
Lillian.
And Linda was hired when we got some money to hire a diversity, somebody, and it wasn't for particularly any particular department, it was a college.
Mm-hmm.
And it was between social sciences and humanities and fine arts, and we had a search committee, and we actually hired two people. One was Linda, and one was somebody, a woman in mm-hmm. sociology.
Mm-hmm.
But we had people from all different disciplines right. coming in mm-hmm. for that, so in some ways it was just luck mm-hmm. that she ended up.
Well, wasn't Luz a top appointment too? Luz, still
I guess Luz was a top appointment, but that was an appointment that came through Latin American Caribbean Studies and then came along mm-hmm. and it was a joint appointment,
right.
but it wasn't someone that we went out and recruited mm-hmm. for. We had a couple of other possibilities, but they, for one reason or another, mm-hmm. didn't come through.
Right.
But one way or another, the thing has built up, and then we got an okay to hire a new person as chair. So we have Vivian, and now it's
and Marjorie.
And then when I went back to the faculty, since mm-hmm. they pulled out the linguistics department, I said, I'll have my line in women's studies. So,
mm-hmm.
And it's all in women's studies, actually.
Right. Do you remember some of the issues that sort of were dealt with in the years? I mean, are there any that stand out in your mind?
Internal issues?
Well, either one, internal or external, but relating to the women's studies mm-hmm. program/department.
Well, I mean, I think that there was a long time when there was a feeling that women's studies was besieged, and people didn't think of it as something legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
And so whether there was so much resentment on the part of other departments, but there was a kind of, let's not do away with it, but let's not let it grow
mm-hmm.
fast attitude on the part of the administration.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was pretty prevalent for a while. And with at least with one president, I said, how did this program grow so fast? You know, let's just keep it down, this
mm-hmm.
sort of thing. Like, it had to be kept under control or it was going to take over and take over the world. So that was, and so that was obviously a constant concern about
mm-hmm.
how not to be squashed
yeah.
because you depended on the administration. Mm-hmm. So every little bit was a struggle, like getting a secretary.
Mm-hmm.
Was it first the part secretary shared with other programs, and then I don't even remember how it actually even ever came about, that it became a full-time secretary.
I don't think we had a full-time secretary until we moved into social sciences.
I think that's true, because I think even when Annette was there, it was half-time, she was mm-hmm. working half-time. That's right. And even that was an advance over what had been before, when it was like 3 or 4 programs that were sharing on secretary. So that was you know, an issue that people were always wondering about. And, you know, I don't think this was especially women's studies, but I remember we had a group of women who went each year to the president to report. I think it was about women's issues in general, but it always included women's studies. And, I mean, it was a custom that got set up, and whether the president liked it or not, they got this report.
Right.
And I don't know whether that's still happening.
I don't know. I was involved in that.
You, yeah.
We
started it with O'Leary.
Right. We started it with O'Leary.
Who was the one who had said, don't let it grow.
Right. And it was a group made up of people from the Women's Concerns Committee, and the Council of Women's Groups, and Women's Studies, and the Secretarial Clerical Council.
Right, so it was the whole group of women's groups.
It was really representative of all the women's groups on campus, including Women's Studies. And it was, I remember that, I'm interviewing you,
that's good, because you were involved.
It was always carefully orchestrated.
Yes, it was very well planned, and people just didn't make an appointment and go in and talk off the top of their head. It was like, you would talk about this, and you would talk about
that. That's right.
That, yeah. No, this was, I think they were useful.
I don't know whether they're still going on, because I've gotten less involved in those groups.
Right. Well, you know, and things move on to a different level.
Right.
I mean, we had this organization, the Caucus on Women's Rights, which was very active for a while, both at our level and statewide, and that really doesn't exist anymore. And partly it was, not that all the women's issues have been solved, but certain ones have been solved, and people moved on because it was the same people. They got tired of doing that, and so they decided, a lot of them began to put more efforts into women's studies, and kind of left that aside. But, you know, that group was instrumental in the affirmative action, like policies, having affirmative action offices, and played a big role in the anti-nepotism, you know, getting
Right,
the book. So, and as I said, pushing women's studies, but
times move on,
things change. And I think this article that I just gave you a copy of, which talks in detail about the early days and I think it was written in 74 or 75, so it's really how it began, the first courses, what the setup was for interdisciplinary programs, and so it certainly doesn't even say anything about a department. And I was trying to say, why did Joan and I write this essay? How come it was the two of us? Well, Joan obviously had been director of it, and I don't know whether it was because I had been for a short time coordinator of interdisciplinary studies, or whether it was the time that the two of us were co-chairs of the caucus. Neither of us remembered writing the thing. Not that it's a great piece of writing, it isn't, but it's interesting because it's got a lot of information in it. Apparently the Feminist Press is going to do an issue celebrating 30 years of women's studies.
Oh, wonderful.
And they want to include in it various articles from the past, plus special things about the future, and among them are several essays on women's studies at different stages that had been published in the past. And it probably was a report we wrote for I guess, Feminist Studies or Women's Studies Quarterly, whatever the thing was called at the time. And so we're not the earliest program, but we were one of the early programs. There were a few around at the time, and which have gone in different directions. I know that the collective, I think, was based in part on a model developed at Buffalo. The idea for it came from, and I remember the Buffalo program was always in trouble. They were always calling for help.
They still are.
Right.
I said, this is like deja vu. Here they are again. Mm-hmm. Because they had a very strong, they had this women's studies college, you know, for a while there. They had these kind of semi-residential colleges. And instead of being a department, that's what they were relegated to. And they had a very strong community involvement. Even the late 60s, early 70s, mm-hmm. where they had community people involved with votes. It was a rather untraditional academic kind of a setup. And that was part of what got them in trouble. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, finally, because they went, part of some of their program, I'm not sure about the undergraduate, but graduate one, went into American studies.
Mm-hmm.
But they were always sending out SOS signals. Called.
Right.
So, and, you know, and so I was involved since I knew the people that were involved. I remember the early stories about setting up the collective and what a big job that was, mm-hmm. actually, setting it up. And it was basically Judith Federley and John Schultz that did that. And, you know, Howard got an award. I think it was at the NWSA.
Mm-hmm.
It got an award for innovative teaching or programming. They will probably remember what the name of the award was. But
well,
it was
John won't, but Judy may.
Well, Judy may. It was cited, certainly, for being a model.
I'll ask about it. Because Joan didn't even mention
it. She didn't mention that.
No, Michelle, she probably forgot.
Mm-hmm. And I think it was in WSA, but it was at some big group that got this special citation. I mean, it wasn't an award. That was handed to them, but it was mentioned. And it's a program that has been fairly salient in that people know about it when they talk about the development of women's studies. Albany is often mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was early enough, maybe different enough to
be noticed.
Yeah.
What about the people? Can you talk about the people who were involved? Both the people who are still here, but some of the ones maybe who came and went.
Thank you, Joan. Well, tell me how much I owe you. Who went? I'm just trying to think of the people who came and went. Yeah, most of the people that I think of when I think about
here.
The program are still here, or else they've just retired, like Joan.
Mm-hmm. I can't think of people who. What about students?
Well, see, I didn't know the students so well because I wasn't actually teaching in it. So, that, you know, when I look at a list of students, occasionally I'll remember them because I knew them in some other setting or, you know, I saw what happened. So that, for example, I have, for some of the women's studies graduates, I've written letters of recommendation, but relatively few. We've had, you know, and a few that I did know, there have been some wonderful students who've done some really interesting things and gone on to interesting careers.
Right.
Yeah. But it would be nice, actually, if we could have a more systematic way of maintaining contact with the alums, because I'm sure a lot of them have interesting things to say and would welcome a contact, but not too many people initiate it. You have to kind of go to that. So I think that will probably happen, but it's a big job.
It's actually a fundraising.
It's something
I would have liked to have.
Yes, it's a good way of raising funds, but it's also a good way of just getting general support and connecting.
Yeah. Right.
And, you know, and helping even present students, because graduates are very often willing to do that kind of thing.
Right.
Most institutions send out, well, they don't do it from departments, but they do it from the institution. They send out notices to their alums saying, would you be willing to mentor a student in your field, have them come and spend a day with you, or even correspond with them. So I think that will come, because I think, you know, having that. But it's very hard to keep up with people. But I think the Alumni Association is doing a better job now of keeping up with people so that it's possible to get some
easier
decent
to do that,
answers.
Right.
Yeah, that would be nice because I think the students, each generation of students has no concept about
but the history of Whitman
right.
before.
Yeah.
I mean, they know the faculty, and they know that some of them have been here for a long mm-hmm. time, but if they would connect better knowing something about the people who had been students here, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody thinks it's the first, they're the first group to have gone through something like this.
Right, right. Do you, when you compare, when you think about the program at its beginning and the department the way it is now, what are some of the major differences that you see? And similarities, I guess, too.
Well, I think that in some ways, when the program first started, it was more closely knit because there were fewer people. There was a feeling of being pioneering or being in the siege or both, and people kind of stuck together. There was a lot of meeting together, talking together, seeing one another quite often, and that's a little less so now
mm-hmm.
because we have a departmental setup and. Doesn't have, sometimes it was a little bit too much. We used to have these, for one time there in the middle period, we had these faculty meetings. They seemed to come up every week. They weren't, but they seemed to have people, and there were big meetings mm-hmm. at which not too much could get accomplished. And so the program has experimented with lots of different ways of doing it, having fewer faculty meetings and having a steering committee. Meet more often, trying to have a big faculty meeting once or twice a semester. But since a lot of the people who are not, the line is not only in women's studies, are kept pretty busy in their other departments too, it's hard to get a lot of attendance and participation, those things. But we do have a core now of people who are in women's studies. Somehow, I think that on the out of the academic, beyond the academic, there isn't as much kind of closeness as it used to be, but that's probably inevitable.
Yeah.
That's a kind of cost of growth,
mm-hmm.
I think. And so you said, well, you know, that was such a nice atmosphere then. It was different.
Mm-hmm.
And we certainly have many more courses now. We have more students. I think we have more students now. It was always attractive to students, so it wasn't ever a question of having not enough students mm-hmm. especially with those early courses,
right.
The literature courses and perspective, and that remains.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it is different, the atmosphere is different, but I think that's inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, Bonnie said something in the meeting today, like we hardly know one another anymore. Because she was remembering that we used to have these get-togethers once or twice a year
mm-hmm.
that we used to call advances instead
right.
of retreats. And it was, and they were not, there was a little business conducted at them, but they basically were ways of meeting outside of the university and socializing a little bit and really getting to know people. And we haven't done that in a while. Like nobody has the energy to organize one.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know whether that means that practice has also run its course and the time has come, or whether someday somebody will get some energy back and do it. But I think it was good. I think there is a little danger of people getting too much involved in their own personal,
mm-hmm.
professional, even professional pursuits and not cohering.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that hasn't happened. Everybody sort of comes, if in times of need, people seem to rally
right.
around and we're right. there. But it's when you don't have any kind of an emergency looming that people go off in their own direction.
Right.
But it still is amazing how loyal people have been whose major appointment's not in women's studies.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because they're, I mean, they believe in women's studies, and what they teach in their own department is very often cross-listed and
mm-hmm.
related to women's studies, and they do have this attachment to the department. We maybe haven't done
quite so much to find out among the new people hired whether there's anybody, whether the people are there that would also be new recruits to them.
Right.
Study. Because there's been a lot of women hired. Now, obviously, a lot of women aren't interested in women's studies, but I think there probably are a few of them that are, and that has to take a lot of work and put one thing first. Because as some of us retire, you want to
right.
get
you
in,
need to
and
get
I need
fresh
to get
blood
fresh.
In, and even just bodies.
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
people
well,
who are willing to do
yeah.
the work that's required.
See, even when it was a program, but I think this is more so when it's a department, that people don't come on board and then come over and say, hey, I'm really interested in women's studies. Can I get involved in some way? That's very unusual.
Mm-hmm.
You usually have to sort of go out to them
yeah.
and tell them a little bit about the program and the department and ask them if they might be interested and invite them to come to a meeting and see what's involved. And then there's always a little bit of anxiety on the part of junior people if they're untenured, dividing, taking their attention away
yeah.
from places where their tenure is going to be decided. Because having been on the council on promotion and continuing appointment for a couple of years, I've seen a number of cases of people who do research, which is very closely allied to, certainly about women and women's studies, but I don't think any of them have ever either evinced any interest or been approached.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I didn't even know about these people, as a matter of fact.
Right.
So.
Right.
But it's an example of how, in some ways, this is an issue. That was an interesting one. And it was one that we talked about a lot after Bonnie Spanier came as director, since one of the areas that she has as her area of expertise is curriculum transformation.
Mm-hmm.
We had this ongoing discussion about whether the program should be putting its efforts into curriculum transformation or into developing its own curriculum, women's studies more. And generally we came down on, I think people came down on the side of, we have a limited amount of energy and it's more important right now to do our own thing and not go out and try to get other departments and other people to start doing women's studies. That was right or wrong, I don't know. But in fact, a lot of curriculum transformation happened sort of on its own by departments hiring people interested in work on women and actually developing sub fields and tracks, stuff having to do with the women. This is sort of amazing that it's like just by having, maybe just by having the women's studies there and at the same time there being a certain amount of pressure, I think, from various women's groups about hiring more women. Some women were going to be hired that had this interest, and then they started this thing going within their own department.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's not universally true across the university, but it's happened in separate departments.
Mm-hmm.
Sociology is a good example.
Yeah, right.
History, who would have thought that history would have had, June Hanna has been there from the early days, but she was a lone person with nobody interested in what she was doing from that point of view. For a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, I don't know whether that's happened anywhere else.
That'd be an interesting phenomenon
because a number of institutions have had conscious curriculum transformation programs. Then the discussion about those programs is, does it happen from the top down? Very often it was administrators deciding we need to have this, here's some money, do it. And I think from the things that I've looked at, but Bonnie would be a better person to talk to about this, that it didn't happen or didn't take hold in any place that didn't already have some nucleus of women's studies as a program or a minor, something like that. And I think that some administrators might have seen it at the beginning as a way to avoid having a program or a department. Let's just put it off. Which could make intellectually
a certain amount of sense, but it didn't, because you need to start from the beginning, and
right.
the beginning is having something which is really focusing just on women, mm-hmm. and then the end being the transformation, so that the curriculum equally represents both groups.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the presence of the core, even if it wasn't a big program, but people who actually did it. And so in many ways, it was the energy and work of that core of women that got those programs going.
Yeah.
And probably in a lot of cases at the expense of women's studies itself.
Right.
And of course, the issue is, you know, should women's studies self-destruct, mm-hmm. and if it's successful, or is there an ongoing reason to mm-hmm. keep it as
something
a program?
Something unique to it.
Yeah, it's still an issue.
Should be retained.
A lot of people that see all those kind of programs, I mean, the ethnic programs and all that, as somehow things that will self-destruct.
Yeah.
Because if you're going to do history will include all of that, you know.
Right.
But if that ever happens, it's a long way off.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think so. I'm going to turn it off for a minute.
Okay.
Do you remember, at one time there was quite a bit of community involvement in women's studies, and do you remember the sequence of events? Do you remember the people who were involved?
No, I'm trying. That's very vague in my mm-hmm. memory. I do remember that they were, and I don't know how. We had community members on the advisory committee. I mm-hmm. remember that.
Right.
And I cannot offhand now remember anybody that was involved. Somebody mentioned names, I might remember. Well, remember
yeah, Martha
them.
Schultz and Cheryl Lee,
Elaine
Onya Benny, and Kathy Ferguson, and
that's right. And it was, they were. And I don't know when that all stopped, or how it mm-hmm. stopped, or whether the people mm-hmm. just sort of drifted. Well, Kathy left,
right,
and Elaine got involved in doing things at Siena, and Martha and Cheryl, I guess, got involved in the women's building,
right.
and then they never got replaced.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there was ever any conscious decision not to have community people, although there might have been, maybe in terms of making it more.
Joan seems to feel
academically, that made it look more academic.
Right.
Not, and in fact, I think those people were not playing a very active role by that time. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I don't remember that in detail.
Mm-hmm.
Very vague.
What about the adjuncts, the people who have taught many of our courses over the years? Did you have a lot of contact with them?
No, I mean, I knew some of them, certainly. I know mm-hmm. Mary and, you know, mm-hmm. and Susan and all that. But I didn't have much direct contact. It seems to me also that they were, though, more involved early on mm-hmm. in terms of beyond just teaching a course than they have been in the mm-hmm. last several years. But it could also be because, you know, get them hired at the last minute, and you never know mm-hmm. one day to the next whether they're going to be. In a sense, that might be another price that's paid by institutionalization of becoming an academic department.
Yeah.
And whether it's necessary to pay that price, I don't know. I think it might, maybe you have to go through certain phases.
Mm-hmm.
And it might be time to start it up again in another guise. And I think that in a sense that what's going on currently with this movement to have a consortium of women's studies
mm-hmm.
programs in the area, maybe another way doing that than and obviously doesn't get people that are completely out of colleges mm-hmm. involved. We talked a lot in the early days about getting high school people involved, mm-hmm. about getting out into the high school. That was an issue, actually, even just in general. I remember even, you know, I think the feminist press was doing a lot. They were trying to put out texts and things that would be used in high schools, with the idea that that's where the interest could begin, and that was in some ways the most important place to start people thinking about women's studies. And I think that it succeeded to a certain extent. I think there's some of that in some schools, but as an official kind of policy or initiative by by college women's studies programs, that seems to have died. And again, you know, everybody's got to concentrate their energies, and it always looks like first things first. But I still think that that's a good idea. I mean, I think that there needs to be more contact and communication between the high schools and higher education, and some kind of link, because all we do is complain about the students that come to us from high school, and if we have no contact with the teachers in the high school, then somehow we don't maybe have the right to complain. I don't think that's specific to women's studies.
Oh no, I don't think so.
The same is true, and there's even less of the involvement of community colleges. Mm-hmm. So now in this consortium, I think some of the community colleges.
Really?
I'm not sure. I can't remember. I have the list of names today, but with the Hudson Valley has been involved in women's studies for quite a while. But I'm sure they must be a member of that consortium. It would make sense.
Right.
But what was interesting is that now Albany Law School has joined it. So that's the other side of it. And that is very, very nice to know, because I think that whole connection of education not being, oh, this is women's studies, something you do in college, and then you forget about it, or beforehand you don't know anything about it. I think that it can be made a continuing part of education. And I think that the high school people, teachers that, you know, that I've known, and I haven't known very many, certainly Martha Schultz was very active in doing that, and I assume she still is. But, and it probably was one of the reasons that she was involved. I don't know how she even got involved, but it was, I don't think she was ever a student at SUNY.
I think Joan thinks it came from the caucus. Or one of the
The Capital District.
Capital District Women's.
Yeah, I wasn't involved in that yet. That was in those early days. Yeah. A lot of stuff, a lot of that people who were not directly part of SUNY came to get to know one another and came through that. And that was a group that had a lot of energy. Speaking all over the place, all kinds of clubs. But I think you kind of have to take advantage of all kinds of opportunities. For example, I was really surprised, but I got a call to ask me if I would give a talk on language and gender in honor of Women's History Month. And it came from a group I had never heard of in my life, the National Credit Union Administration.
How interesting.
And what happened is they apparently, which is a group which is the they regulate the credit unions like the bank regulators. And it's a federal agency, but it's run out of dues paid by the credit unions rather than by tax money.
Yeah.
And they apparently have a policy of recognizing all special months like Black History Month, Women's History Month, whatever, Hispanic Heritage Month. And so my name was in that speaker's directory. And one woman that looked at it said, oh, this would be an interesting topic. So, you know, whatever, this is a group of people who probably never heard of women's studies or never heard about women, but that, and you know, you could see, because I always try, if I go to some group like that, of including certain situations that I know that they would have come across, like the situation of being the only woman in a meeting, saying things and having nobody pay attention to it. And then some man saying something a little later and everybody saying what a good idea, and they all kind of ears perk up and say, oh yeah, we know about that. So, it puts a sort of burden on people. You've got to be always going around being willing to let more people in on what women's studies is all about and what it can do. But I do think it's important, because it's still a big puzzle to people. I guess I'm used to being in disciplines that are still big puzzles. People don't know what linguistics is either.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
movement, you know, and I think that's important. Because I think that there is a, although there's, you know, kind of conservative tendency to say, no, what do we need women's studies for? But I think there is a lot of potential goodwill and even support out there.
Yeah.
For much more. That, I think, has really increased over the past 10 years mm-hmm. or so. But, mm-hmm. Women are willing to now come out and say right. that. This was an example that had nothing to do with women's studies, but it would have to do with women. I've been going around trying to get some door prizes for the Zonta benefit. And Zonta is this women's service organization, and the proceeds go to three women's organizations, Girls Club and the Next Step, which is for recovering alcoholics and drug abuse people, and the Displaced Homemakers Center. And people have been, I got a couple of nice surprises, but a couple people have said, I really like this because it has to do with women, because it supports women.
Ah.
And so these were women that said it, but it's okay. Okay, so you get that idea that, I don't know, 10 years ago not too many people would have said that.
Yeah.
And, you know, even then, this is a fairly young woman, actually, and, you know, you get people talk about, well, a lot of young women don't think they have to be feminists because they think, or study women's studies because they think the battle's been won
right.
and there really
yeah.
is equality and they're all going to be okay. But I think that may be true. Because I think that Vivian has been going out into the community
mm-hmm.
and been talking to groups and getting some community women's groups at
right.
least, if not involved, at mm-hmm. least knowledgeable about things. I think
right.
that, and you know, that's not the same as bringing them in.
But
to our program, but maybe that's not what we need right,
right
now.
Right. Yeah. What do you see for the future of the department? If you see anything for the future, I mean, you know.
Well, I see graduate programs. I see masters and PhD. I think that, you know, I think it has a bright future. I don't think it's ever going to have like hundreds of majors
mm-hmm.
or hundreds of graduate mm-hmm. students in terms of people specializing in it. But I think it's going to grow, and I think it's going to have a nice solid basis, because there definitely is a need for it and also a recognition on the part of
mm-hmm.
women. And I think maybe even more so at the graduate level
mm-hmm.
of people, both people who've taken women's studies as undergraduates and people who might have just taken a course or two, and when they begin to set their own goals or
mm-hmm.
go into their own careers, want to do something that is geared in some way towards serving women, and so want to come back and maybe do another master's, or
mm-hmm.
particularly a master's in women's studies.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there's a bright future for it. And I think, I mean, obviously the undergraduate still is going to be important, and maybe more so in terms of the students taking courses and maybe minoring in it. So I don't know how much the undergraduate majors are going to grow in number,
mm-hmm.
but I do think that the graduate program mm-hmm. is going to be interesting. Again, it's not going to have, like, psychology. God knows how many graduate students are in it. But everybody thinks that's the only way to get a job is to become a psychologist. But a person who's in psychology and wants to do women's studies, that's a really strong combination.
Right.
It's a
mm-hmm.
wonderful combination with a number
mm-hmm.
of different things. And,
yeah.
And there's obviously need for... And we see even now, I mean, the numbers maybe aren't huge, but in the Doctor of Arts and Humanistic Studies,
mm-hmm.
there's always some students who come into it because they want to do something else but to combine it with women's studies. I had a student from RPI, a graduate student, who took my course in minors and gender last semester, and she is getting her master's there in intermediate art.
Mm-hmm.
They have a special arts program. But she said she wanted to go on, and the reason she wanted to go on was that she wanted to do some more work with text and with feminist theory.
Mm.
So, did I have any ideas? And I said, well, you want to teach
in academic. She said, no, I want to be an artist, but I want to, know mm-hmm. more about this. So I suggested that the GIA program, in which you could combine
right.
the art and mm-hmm. and the feminist theory, and so she went to speak to Vivian, and she went to speak to Roberta Bernstein, and she's got accepted. I don't know whether she's actually going to come, mm-hmm. but who knows? I think as an undergraduate, who knows whether she even had any interest in women at all, but mm-hmm. sometimes it's kind of late that she said, I need to know more about this. I need to read more.
So, let me turn it off.
Okay.